Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Yet another revelation this morning about the meeting last year between Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and people they were told would provide incriminating information about Hillary Clinton as part of the Russian government's interest in helping Trump get elected. NBC News is reporting that there was another person in the room who has not been previously discussed or identified, and they haven't released his name. But NBC describes the person as a Russian-born American lobbyist who once was a Soviet counterintelligence officer. The lobbyist denies current ties to any Russian intelligence agencies, though some U.S. officials suspect otherwise, NBC reports. Curiouser and curiouser. Now, one thing that has really changed this week, because the public now knows about this meeting, is the entire Trump world argument for why the Russia business is not a scandal. It's been flipped on its head. They used to argue that it's not a scandal because there was no collusion. What patriotic American would do such a thing?
Did any advisor or anybody in the Trump campaign have any contact with the Russians who were trying to meddle in the election?
Well, of course not.
Of course not that. Mike Pence on CBS in January, just one of many examples. But now they're arguing the opposite. Yes, they did it, but collusion's not a heinous thing after all. Here's the president yesterday.
Most people would have taken that meeting. It's called opposition research or even research into your opponent. I've had many people, I have only been in politics for 2 years, but I've had many people call up, oh, gee, we have information on this factor or this person or, frankly, Hillary. That's very standard in politics. Politics is not the nicest business in the world, but it's very standard where they have information and you take the information. I think the press made a very big deal over something that really a lot of people would do.
So it wasn't a scandal previously because they wouldn't have done such a horrible thing. Now it's not a scandal because they did it, but it's not such a horrible thing. You can accept or reject that argument, but just for the record, it's the opposite argument of the whole last year. We'll talk about that now, plus Mitch McConnell Care 3.0 and more with Neera Tanden, president and CEO of the progressive think tank, the Center for American Progress. She's also a former senior advisor to President Obama and Senator Clinton. Thanks for coming on, Neera. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be on with you.
How serious do you think this meeting was and the whole idea of accepting opposition research from Russia?
I mean, I think the arguments of the Trump White House are ludicrous on their face. And the idea that every campaign would accept basically an offer of collusion from a foreign government is absurd. And it's obviously not part of any campaign I've ever been part of or anyone I know, and Republican or Democrat. And so,
well, you were a Hillary Clinton advisor, and one of the points they're making is that a Ukrainian government official sought to help the Clinton campaign because Ukraine was being attacked by Russia, and they thought Clinton would be stronger in its defense. And we may like Ukraine better, but if the law and the ethical standard is no foreign government help in a U.S. presidential campaign, it backs up the president's claim there that many people take such meetings, so they say. Is that wrong?
Yes, it's absolutely wrong. I mean, I appreciate that this has been a talking point of the Republicans for the last week, but the Ukrainian meeting did not really happen with anyone at a high level in the Clinton campaign. There was no effort to say the Ukrainian government is here to help the Clinton campaign defeat Donald Trump. They were providing some information as far as we can see, but there's no Ukrainian spy in the meeting. There were no efforts to basically sabotage the Trump campaign. And what we also have is the background of what's happened in the actual election, which is that we know that the Russian government used its intelligence apparatus to spread the WikiLeaks information, basically stole emails from the Clinton campaign and distributed it online. Of course.
Well, obviously, folks, we're having trouble with Neera Tanden's line. Let's see if that fell off altogether. Neera, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I've heard you all along.
Okay. So we were getting some blasting noises on your line. Hopefully it's cleared up now. Go ahead and finish that thought.
I was just pointing out that in the WikiLeaks document that essentially the Russian government, the context of all of this is that the Russian government basically stole emails from the Hillary Clinton campaign and distributed them via WikiLeaks. Obviously, none of that happened with the Ukrainians.
Some of your emails, as has been reported during the campaign, were released.
If I knew we were discussing my emails, I certainly wouldn't have come on the show.
Well, I'm not going to ask you about the content of your emails. There's really no point in that at this point. But they were mostly your internal critiques of how specific things were being done in the Clinton campaign. And in a way, my point is that if you ask the average American on the street, the average American voter, about anything that you said that got leaked or anything that John Podesta wrote, people don't know what they were. They weren't the Comey letter or other arguably much bigger things. Average Americans probably couldn't identify anything from the Podesta emails if asked an open-ended question, if they could. So my question is, the Trump people are saying, look, none of this made a difference anyway. The election didn't hinge on anything that WikiLeaks released because these weren't big enough issues. So therefore, the media and the Democrats are making too big a deal about it. It doesn't illegitimize the election. What do you say to that?
I guess I would unpack a few things there. First of all, we don't actually have to have a standard of delegitimizing the entire election for basically collusion or any other act to be illegal. And so, that's why we have a special prosecutor, whether it delegitimized the election or not. Having said that, in a race that is 70,000 votes across three states, it's hard to say no issue mattered. And I would point out that WikiLeaks dominated press coverage, dominated cable news week after week after week. And so it's a little hard to say that it didn't affect 70,000 votes in three states. But I think actually your framing of this, it goes to a much more important point, which is how the media covered WikiLeaks. And, as you stated, my emails were mostly the musings of the internal actions of the campaign. That is actually false. I had thousands of emails. There were only a few on the internal apparatus or internal operations of the campaign, but those were taken out of context by the American media, and who sadly, it's sad to say, became the kind of willing handmaidens of the Russian intelligence. And you can see what happened in France. The media in France decided to deal with the WikiLeaks document dumps and different aspects of email use, etc., in a completely different way. And so, we don't need to litigate the ins and outs of the 2016 campaign. There were tons of mistakes made by everyone, the Clinton campaign, the media, lots of forces. But I think when we step back here, the reality is that our intelligence forces have said that the Russian government have found that the Russian government was trying to help the Trump campaign. So shockingly enough, that is an actual email that has been released by Donald Trump Jr. It is in the heading. And the Trump forces have rejected that for the last year, and Donald Trump's own email shows that that was true. And I think we are just at the tip of the iceberg of the Russia issue. We now know of dozens of meetings between Russian officials and Trump campaign people at the highest levels. And so we need to, this is the reason why we have a special prosecutor, and I'm glad he's investigating.
We don't know yet if Trump Jr.'s claim is true, that they got no dirt on Clinton after all at that meeting. We also don't know if he really didn't tell his father about it at the time. The timeline has come under scrutiny in this regard. Trump Sr. left another meeting and was likely in Trump Tower while that meeting was taking place there. Would Jr. really not have told him about such an encounter? And Trump Sr. then gave a speech promising more to come on the Clintons. The Trump Jr. email exchange before the meeting Beijing said the information would be especially useful later in the summer. And then later in the summer, boom, right as the Democratic convention was starting, out came the first DNC hacked emails. Any thoughts about the timeline?
I mean, if you made up these facts, people would think it would be too strange for fiction. The fact that ultimately we had the first number of WikiLeaks documents got dumped just within minutes of the Access Hollywood video going out, when usually every other day they went out at 9 a.m. except for the first day, they went out within 20 minutes of the Access Hollywood videotape. It's just strains credulity that all of this is a massive, massive just coincidence. And against all of this, you know, we're learning about facts now. If the Trump campaign and Trump officials and Trump White House were innocent, why not just release all of this information months ago? Why not have Jared Kushner actually put all of this in his disclosure forms? I mean, the disclosure forms are designed to actually find this information. He's been updating them constantly with the information as it comes out in the press. Just does not smack of innocent behavior in any way, shape, or form.
Listeners, if you have a question for Neera Tanden, President and CEO of the Center for American Progress, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Oh, and there goes that noise again. Hopefully it'll just disappear again. Let's talk about the Senate health care bill. A Ted Cruz amendment in the new version would make states guarantee that the full Obamacare essential benefits package be available in at least one plan in each state, as long as they can also offer bare bones plans that would have low income premiums, presumably for younger, healthier people. Is that a good deal for everyone in your view, because it preserves choice along the range?
I mean, what is startling about managed to make the repeal and replacement bill much, much worse. What this means, essentially.
All right, you know what? We're going to fix this problem. I understand that your assistant is sitting with you in the office and has another phone ready to go because of the problem that we were having before, and now it's recurred. So, Neera, as quickly as you can, switch phones, and maybe you did it already. Yay. Sorry about that. Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. So go ahead and you can start that answer over, actually, because you were getting pretty interfered with on the Senate health care bill and that Ted Cruz amendment in particular.
I'm so sorry about all of this. So all I was saying was that what's startling about where we are in the health care bill and the health care process is that the Senate replacement of the ACA has managed to get much, much worse. One Republican senator after another has said that they will protect pre-existing conditions, and yet the Cruz Amendment essentially gets those by offering protections of pre-existing conditions in one plan. Other plans within the exchanges will not have those. So obviously, people who need pre-existing conditions protections will go into the plan that protects them. Everyone else, healthier people, will not take that plan because it'll be more expensive, and you'll create essentially what is called in health insurance a death spiral where insurance becomes really unaffordable. So essentially what the Cruz Amendment does is say, if you need protections for pre-existing conditions, we're going to price out of the market, which existed before. That's almost basically what it was like before in health insurance. So I think the real challenge there is for every moderate who had concerns about the bill to begin with, the bill has managed to get really much worse in significant, significant ways. And so I'm hopeful that the Republican senators who said they opposed the bill before will continue to oppose it. But obviously Mitch McConnell is doing a range of side deals, trying to buy off particular senators or language that helps buy off Alaska. I'm hoping Murkowski will oppose it. Senator Murkowski will still oppose it, but that's something to be seen.
It's interesting because they were so critical of a few of the particular state compromises that helped Obama get passed, the Cornhusker, whatever it was called, for Nebraska.
Kickback. And now that I just need to say, was not in the final package of the legislation.
And now they're looking for specific giveaways or gives to Alaska, also to Florida, I understand. So that's interesting.
To Louisiana, you know, there are different elements of this to just particularly buy up votes. And I think it is really legislative, the worst legislative process I've ever seen. Just as a reminder, there hasn't been a single hearing, a single markup on this bill. It's all taking place essentially behind closed doors. And I think the reason why that's happening is because they're essentially ashamed of this legislation. You know, they will have a final version of this bill literally days between, you know, its offering to the public and you know, a vote. And as with the Affordable Care Act, we had the bill on the floor for months before there were, you know, final votes.
Why do you think, and I realize you're on the other side from them, and so it's going to be that kind of critique, but why do you think that the Republicans are so interested in higher insurance premiums for the sick? Because that's what that Ted Cruz amendment really does. And I think they do have this kind of philosophical aversion to smoothing out the cost of premiums by charging younger, healthier people more in pursuit of saving premium costs for the older and the sicker. They really believe that the sicker people should pay higher insurance premiums. You know, like we do on our car insurance, you're going to get priced on your individual risk. But you don't want that for health insurance. Why do you think they do?
I actually think this is a great question. I actually think that throughout this debate, what's happened is that you see Republicans actually oppose the entire idea of insurance itself. I mean, I was really struck by the discussion during the House bill where Paul Ryan did a whole press conference on health care, on his health care bill, and then talked about the outrage of younger, healthier people paying for sicker, older people. And now the whole concept of insurance is that, you know, if you're a younger, healthier person, at some point you will likely be an older, sicker person. And so we pool our risk together. And then, you know, the younger people pay for the older people, but the older people paid in when they were younger. So, you know, in your lifetime, it works out to be a much better deal for you. And I have to say what I've been shocked by, and your question goes right to this, is that throughout this debate, Republicans have been outraged by the mere as some kind of socialism or something that, you know, which is, it's obviously not. As part of a market, people get insurance all the time. They pool their risk all the time. And so I think that the idea there is one that I do not understand their opposition.
Jim in Milburn, New Jersey, you're on WNYC with Neera Tanden from the Center for American Progress. Hello, Jim. Jim, are you there? Jim once. Jim twice. Let's go to John in the Bronx. John, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Well, my question is in terms of this whole thing, not only about health care, but about the Russian situation and the collusion, my question is, what would you think the situation or the circumstances will be if Hillary Clinton was in office and she will be, and she and her staff will be accused of collusion with the Russians? How will the media treat Hillary Clinton if this was on her shoes?
Well, it's a hypothetical. John, are you asking it because you think you know the answer?
Well, yes. The answer will be that she will be treated way, way harshly than Donald Trump and his cohorts have been treated.
John, thank you very much. Well, it is interesting, Neera, that both campaigns, I think it's fair to say, came out thinking that the media was really, really unfair to them. You reflected a little bit of that here this morning, and I'm sure Secretary Clinton would have a lot to say. And of course, and of course, Trump feels that he's, you know, completely unfairly treated by the media. You know all the things that he said. So what would you say to John?
Look, you know, I think the most important thing is to really look forward. I mean, we could debate the 2016 coverage of Hillary Clinton until the cows come home. But what's really happening here is we have Donald Trump as president of the United States, and who his own Justice Department has a special prosecutor investigating, is like basically made the special prosecutor, created the special prosecutor. And we have so much evidence here that justifies a thorough and deep investigation. And I think the challenge for the Trump White House is that it has no credibility on these issues because, you know, as you pointed out at the top of the show, a lot of the things they've said about this whole issue, Donald Trump Jr. himself was asked about meeting with Russians almost a year ago. He said it never happened. And truth be told, it did happen, and it had just happened recently. So I think the reality of this is that, you know, I think the media is now doing an important role in trying to create accountability. There is a Mueller investigation. I think that we should have also better investigations, particularly in the House, which has been a little bit marred by partisanship. But I hope all the facts will come out. I mean, it's really shocking the number of facts that have come out so far. And I'm not going to litigate whether, you know, the hypotheticals of the Clinton coverage.
Melody in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Neera Tanden. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering if you think it's possible that the situation with Trump and his campaign is even worse than collusion, and possibly that the Russians are the ones who got him to run in the first place, kind of like the Manchurian candidate. And I know this will sound crazy to people. I'm not a partisan Democrat. I'm an independent voter. But there are these intelligence reports. This was mentioned on MSNBC that indicated back in 2015, before he announced he was running for president, intercepts were picked up with Russian officials talking about multiple meetings with Trump associates. Then we have all these large payments from Russians going into Trump businesses on deals where he couldn't get funding elsewhere. We have the estate he sold in southern Florida, where he made a $50 million profit when the market wasn't that good and he'd made no improvements to the property. So just curious, I mean, could this even be worse than a lot of us imagine?
This is what's fascinating about the entire Trump-Russia saga. It is, I mean, it does feel like it is a script of a movie. And you think to yourself, well, it can't really, I mean, it just seems so crazy. But, you know, if you put all the facts together, we need to let the facts come out, right? So I'm not going to get ahead of those facts, to be fair to everything, but to Trump and everyone else. But the reality is that the New York Times reported months ago that British, German, and Dutch intelligence forces have found multiple meetings between Trump associates and Russian actors all throughout Europe as early as, you know, early 2015, and so ahead of the campaign and throughout that. In fact, British intelligence were amongst the first to alert American intelligence of these meetings. And so, you know, I think this is exactly why we need both a thorough investigation by a special prosecutor, but we also need an open process, and why we have called, the Center for American Progress, have called for an independent commission from the beginning, because we need to actually have an open inquiry so the public can understand, you know, whether these are innocent meetings or not. It, you know, just having an up or down on this down the road from Mueller is not going to satisfy the concerns of the public. And that is why, you know, we've called for an independent commission. To this day, do not understand how Republicans have opposed that.
Another point that they make is that the Obama administration engaged in foreign interference in a foreign election by helping an opponent of Netanyahu in the Israeli election. As a former Obama advisor, did they do that? And is that different?
I don't even know what this issue is. Is this helping Herzog? Because I don't actually remember what the aid of Herzog was. I do think there was
something about a $400,000, I think, U.S. fund that was used by an opponent, and I don't know if it was Herzog or somebody else, you know, U.S. government money, used in the campaign against Netanyahu?
I think this is a strategy that that people use. It's called whataboutism, which is to say there is, you know, there's some rough equivalent between these two things. And so, you know, everybody does it. And I just ask the listeners to just think through. I have never heard of any Republican or Democrat taking meetings from a foreign government that said, a foreign government that has been adversarial, that has said, we want to help elect you and hurt your opponent. And they've taken a meeting to get dirt. I've never had that experience. I've worked on multiple presidential campaigns. Never happened in my lifetime. And then had to see such blatant evidence of it occurring during the election, in which, you know, our intelligence forces basically said that the Russians were using WikiLeaks documents to hurt Hillary's campaign and get Trump elected. What? I mean, there is a pattern here that just seems obvious that has never occurred, as far as I can remember, I mean, in the last several decades with American officials.
One more on the politics of the fate of Obamacare. Jeffrey in Ridgefield, Connecticut. We've got 30 seconds for you, Jeffrey. Hi.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. My question for your speaker is really, what kind of message she would have for the population of West Virginia and Kentucky who have apparently voted so much against their own best interest? I'll drop off and listen to the answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think he's referring to health care in particular as well as in general.
Yeah, I think health care is a great example. So, you know, when we talk to people who have received health care from the Affordable Care Act in West Virginia or Kentucky, you know, it's fascinating. Those people really relied on Donald Trump telling them that they would get something better, something cheaper, something more affordable. They like, you know, they like the health care they've received from the Affordable Care Act, whether it's part of the Medicaid expansion or through the exchanges. And, you know,
it's funny, we just have 20 seconds, but Kentucky has been held up as an example of a successful Obamacare exchange, and yet look who they elect as their two senators, Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell.
Fascinatingly enough, Rand Paul is likely to vote against this bill, not on grounds that I like, but he might have the same results. So I think the reality of this is that, you know, there is bipartisan Trump supporters based on the Affordable Care Act replacement bill. There's a lot of opposition to this bill. There's a lot of Republican opposition to this bill. Republicans aren't all getting in line on this bill. There's, you know, a good third to half of Republicans are opposed to this legislation, and that is why I think it is having the problems it has. Because more and more Americans recognize the benefit of the Affordable Care Act, and that is something for which I am proud.
Neera Tanden, President and CEO of the Center for American Progress, thank you so much.
Thank you.